screen starts glowing, and the film starts rolling. You wanna be knowing what you might be in for, so give the show a listen. In front of what you're missing, put yourself in position. But the instinct gets your
Right, here we go. Part two of this April Fool's Day episode, we're going to talk about the music video for You Belong With Me by Taylor Swift. Right, I've been wanting to find space to talk about this music video for a while now. Maybe since the pod started. I don't know if I quite had it formed that I needed to talk about it on the pod, but I knew at some point that I needed to talk about it. And I initially had this as a thought of, like, wouldn't it be silly if I just devoted a whole episode to this one music video? Because as you'll see tonight, I don't know how long this is going to go, but I have a lot to say, a lot of context and thoughts to share about this video.
Dan Carlin, who makes very long podcast episodes, says he's addicted to context.
I ultimately think that this is probably the right space for it, an April Fool's episode. And I think in many ways, this is a good pairing. Because it's an April Fool's episode, I don't necessarily need to justify it as standalone cinema, although I believe that it is. But what I actually want to do is I want to channel Action Button. I want to take his enthusiasm, his deep appreciation for the thing that he's talking about, and all of the contours to it that lead him to loving it, with the same fire that he has, the same passion, the same energy. So maybe I do that all the time, I don't know, but I'm going to try to do it especially here.
Well, I'm on board if we get some flashbacks, if you're living your whole life as you watch this music video.
So he broke his review into segments, and I'm going to do the same. So the first segment, I'm going to talk about the context of Taylor Swift and how that kind of leads to this song. Then I'm going to talk about the song itself. And then at last, we'll talk about the video for the song. And then from there, like the video itself, we'll talk about the component pieces, like the cast and the crew and the setting. And then we're going to talk about the video on a shot-by-shot basis. I won't bring up every single one of the 120 shots in this music video, but I'll kind of give an overview of it. And then I want to confront some of the questions, ideas, and images that it raises. After that, I think we must, unfortunately or fortunately, discuss some of the fallout of this music video and why it has kind of inadvertently become one of, like, the most important American cultural moments of the 21st century, or at least a major piece of the moment that is one of the most important moments. And lastly, I want to interrogate whether this is the single most Dancore filmed narrative ever made, Brian. There's a possibility the answer is yes.
Whoa. That's a bold claim. I mean, I guess who better to make that judgment than you?
We'll see. I don't think it's a definitive one way or the other.
It sounds like Taylor Swift has your pipe.
Has my pipe.
The cat has your pipe, Dan.
Oh.
How quickly we forget. That's definitely the meter stick I'm using to gauge whether I love these long discussions. I think you are ready to talk at length, possibly for comic purposes, which is what
guy
did with the pipe strip.
So let's start with Taylor Swift. It almost goes without saying that she's the most famous person in the English-speaking world right now. The only possible exception I could come up with was Donald Trump. And I would say that's actually only a possible exception because, for example, my two kids know who Taylor Swift is, but they don't know who Donald Trump is. And, you know, probably almost everyone who knows who Donald Trump is knows who Taylor Swift is.
Right. Well, they were both recent time persons of the year. So, but Taylor Swift was this year's person of the year. So she's at the top of cultural cachet.
She's almost certainly the biggest pop star since Michael Jackson. And I've actually seen debates about whether we should just go ahead and say she's the biggest pop star since we've had the notion of pop stars. And quite honestly, there is something to that. Nobody's ever had a reign quite like hers where you could say that she's like one of the 5 or 10 biggest pop stars in the world for close to 20 years, certainly more than 15 years, and has been like the number one undisputed pop star for more than 5 years now, probably going on 6 or 7 years, where no one can challenge that, basically. I would say the main argument that she's not the biggest pop star ever is that she really has never had a moment quite as inescapable as Michael Jackson's Thriller album, and just more broadly, the monoculture where everyone knows and follows the same things. It just ain't what it used to be.
Right. We're never going to have a MASH finale again.
Exactly. There's just too much easily accessed content out there. It's literally impossible for anyone or anything to have the same culture-wide centrality that, like you said, the MASH finale or like the peak stars of the pre-internet days did. But as for how she has been so popular, it's definitely been like she's been lucky in some ways, but like honestly, it really comes down to savviness in crafting her image, which is this, she really has done a great job of presenting herself as this kind of complex, multitudinous person with music that kind of defines that image. But despite it having so many different looks and feels over the course of 20 years, it still kind of feels like a complete and authentic whole. Like you're actually connecting with the person. Like you have a parasocial relationship with her just by listening to all of her music.
Right. And her persona, I would say, as something of an outsider, is that she's fairly wholesome. I don't know. That's what I get. Maybe you're more nuanced than that. I would say that my experience is that I like Taylor Swift, but I like Taylor Swift in the way that I like the Beatles. And maybe you could say the same thing too, Dan, but it means different things for both of us, which is that for me, it comes on the radio and I don't turn it off. I say, oh, this song is pretty good.
I think there's something to that. She definitely has never aggressively sexed up her material or like made sex the commodity that she's dealing. Her work has become more mature, and her recent albums have had swears and pretty clear references to sex. It's become more mature, but I'd say overall still wholesomeness, like someone you would want to be friends with and spend your time with, is a big part of that for sure. And she's released 10 studio albums. Her 11th album, which is called The Tortured Poets Department, is due to come out just a couple of weeks after this recording. It's like April 19th or something like that. She's also re-recorded and re-released 4 of her studio albums with the Taylor's Version moniker, and they get about as much buzz as like an actual album release. I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute here too. Each of her studio albums has also resulted in like a massive tour, and she's released concert films for a bunch of her tours. The most recent one, which was called the Eras Tour, she actually released in theaters, which I don't think she had done before, certainly not to this scale. And it made ridiculous amounts of money. In the US, it was like one of the 5 highest grossing movies of the year last year, or like maybe it was number 7 or something, but it like made 9 digits in revenue, which is crazy. She's become a capitalism machine as much as like a creative machine. But I got on the Taylor bandwagon pretty early, honestly. Like sometime around the release of her second album, Fearless, which is actually the album that You Belong With Me comes from. And it was the 3rd single from Fearless.
So what year was that? Like, what, 2009 or something? When was it?
Yeah, so the album, I'll get to that in a minute here, but the album came out in late 2008 and the single came out in early 2009, I think. So it's not like being a Taylor Swift fan at that point was really an exclusive club. Like she was already probably one of the 15 biggest pop stars in the planet as soon as her second album came out. And she pretty much fully escaped like the country music ecosystem that she had come up in, and that her first album had much more kind of directly operated in. I mean, people were still calling her a country artist until at least her 4th album, even though she was basically making straight teen pop that just had a little bit of a country sheen to it. But back in 2014, I picked her during my top 100 everything series on our old blog, earnthis.net. I picked her as my 16th favorite music artist of all time, which at the moment felt like I was just being a crazy fanboy, just giving too much credence to a pop princess. But like nowadays, there are just legions of people who have her as by far their all-time favorite artist, you know? It's like, if you're a zillennial girl, you know, you honestly could probably guess and be pretty likely that Taylor Swift is your favorite artist of all time. But even as far back as her second album back in 2008 when it first came out, anyone who was really paying attention and who liked music could tell that she was something special. Like, this was before she had ascended to the number one spot, but she just always has had ridiculously good writing chops, crazy consistent albums that run really deep, and that image thing. She's got this emotional accessibility, that wholesomeness that she called it, that kind of bridged a gap between two songwriting styles in my mind. It's like the sort of 80s singer-songwriter, like a Bruce Springsteen type, blended with like the Max Martin style teen pop from the late 90s. There's this critic I've referenced a bunch of time, a music critic named Tom Breehan, and he was an early advocate of Taylor's as well. And he coined a phrase in his review of Fearless, the second album, that has kind of become semi-famous. He said it was in some New York periodical, some hip one like Village Voice, or I don't know which one it was, but he put in his review, respect motherfucking craft. And this was about, you know, an 18-year-old who had just released a country pop album. But he kind of proposed the idea that she was a more serious artist than critics and, you know, gatekeepers in culture more or less gave her credit for at the time. But I don't want to go like through her entire career here, although I think it's a really interesting career in a whole bunch of ways that's really still going on. But honestly, my interest tailed off a little bit in the past few albums. Like, I definitely followed her career much more closely through her first like five or six albums than her last few. But let's talk about Fearless and talk about You Belong With Me. So, like I said, her second album. The album came out November 11th, 2008. And the single came out April 20th, 2009. So to answer your question, album, which is when people first heard the song, late 2008, single 09. And the music video might have been on MTV or whatever before this, but it was uploaded to YouTube on June 16th, 2009. Which, by the way, just a few days after I turned 21, and Swift had just turned 20. So she's pretty close in age to you, Brian. She was born in 1989 sometime.
That's what I was going to say, is no connection to me other than same age, but I feel like a swell of pride that she's like still in the game, because I feel old. Like, I feel too old to be a pop star, but it helps that she's been doing it as long as she has.
Yeah, definitely. So You Belong With Me, for me, is one of two Taylor Swift songs that I would definitively put among my 100 favorite songs of all time by any artist. The other one would be All Too Well, which came from her album Red in 2012. And You Belong With Me was written by Taylor Swift. She's co-written or written all of her songs. There may be an asterisk on that, but I'm pretty sure she has. And it was actually co-written by someone named Liz Rose. And according to what I've read, Liz Rose assisted on the lyrics more so than the music. So this other woman, Liz Rose, she's a country songwriter who is paired with a bunch of pop country crossovers, like Carrie Underwood, for example. Like, one thing you'll learn about country music is it's basically centered in Nashville and has kind of its own whole ecosystem of stuff, and only sometimes crosses over with like the pop music machine. At least historically, that might be compressing since then, but that's kind of historically what you would hear. But Liz Rose and Taylor Swift have co-written on 15 different songs. And actually, All Too Well, the one that I said is another one of my favorites by her, was the last of the collaborations between Liz Rose and Taylor Swift. for whatever reason, I think they write well together. I like almost all the songs that they've co-written together.
You know what this discussion brings me back to is when I did Behind the Wheel, the like driver's ed program that you do where you're actually driving a car around the neighborhood. I did it in 2008. So I was 18 by that point. I got my driver's license late. But on the radio, there were like three songs that just played over and over. And one of them was Teardrops on My Guitar by Taylor Swift.
Yep. That's from her first album. And that's a co-write with Liz Rose, if I'm not mistaken.
You're right.
Now, apparently Swift actually wrote the music to You Belong With Me all by herself. And she actually co-produced it with this guy named Nathan Chapman, who I don't really know anything about, except that he produced a bunch of the music on her first five albums, which means he's probably more in the country universe than the pop universe. But they also made a pop mix of You Belong With Me because they thought, incorrectly, I would say, they thought that maybe the pop radio wouldn't want to play the original mix of You Belong With Me, which has a little bit of banjo and kind of country touchstones in it. Although to me, it just sounds like a pop song. Like it doesn't really sound that much like a country song. But I think you can just ignore the pop mix. Just when you look up the song, the one you're going to hear, unless you're explicitly looking for the pop mix, will be the original album version, which is you sometimes see as the country mix or the original mix. That's what I say you should go listen to. There's also the re-release, and I'll talk a little bit more about the re-release here in a minute, but the song clocks in at 3 minutes and 52 seconds. It's one of a couple of songs from Fearless that made it to number 2 on Billboard. Now, she didn't have a song that hit number 1 on Billboard until her fourth album, Red, which is kind of crazy to think about because she definitely was a high enough profile artist to hit number 1. Like, she was all over the place, but she never actually did hit number 1 until then. And Tom Breehan, who I've already mentioned, he's the guy who did the Respect Motherfucking Craft review. He also has a column called The Number Ones, which I know I've brought up a bunch of times on the pod. I really like this column, where he reviews every song that hits Billboard number 1 and rates it out of 10. But he also sometimes gives ratings to songs that don't quite make number 1, but that still make the top 10 in some way. And he is very careful in giving out full 10 out of 10 marks to songs. But he actually did give You Belong With Me a rare and coveted 10 out of 10. He called it in this review a laser-guided country banger that aches like MySpace emo and slams like Swedish teen pop, which I think is a good turn of phrase. I like that. So if you look at the song closely, like the composition of it, and I have spent a little bit of time looking at it and thinking about it, it uses a pretty straightforward chord progression, like a diatonic chord progression, which is like a normal chord progression. It goes F sharp, C sharp, G sharp minor to B for the verses. And it does two measures each of those chords. And then the pre-chorus, it switches to a slightly different progression. And it just does it for one measure each, which kind of amps up the energy. The chords are changing a little bit faster. And then the chorus has a really iconic vocal part. Like the distinctive part she sings, "So why can't you see you belong with me?" But when she sings the word "see," she breaks it into three parts. And the first one is the highest. And then she goes down just a half step for the middle one. And then for the third one, she goes down multiple full steps. So it's "see." And this is actually like really interesting. It gives the song, like this moment in particular, a very expressive, almost like a plaintive longing quality to it. And this was the first time that she used this writing technique, but she actually has used it a whole bunch where they actually call it the T-drop. If you ever read about Taylor Swift's songwriting, where at some point in her song, she'll do like a sequence where it starts high and then goes a little bit lower and then goes much lower. I mean, it's not like a totally original songwriting idea in general. Like if you've ever studied opera, Wagner opens Tristan and Isolde with a similar leitmotif that people call the longing and desire leitmotif, which goes like, I drink to you. And it sounds kind of similar.
Tea drops on my guitar.
There you go. Yeah. Okay. So we haven't even gotten to the video yet. We're going to get there. But I actually want to talk a little bit more about the song itself and the lyrics of the song, because even though the video is more or less like a direct adaptation of the lyrics, I actually think there are some things to consider in the lyrics before you apply it to the video itself. So I want to talk a little bit about that. So the song opens with the line, "You're on the phone with your girlfriend. She's upset." And this does a great job of like just setting an image in your head of what's happening in the story. And it also does something structurally that's important, which it states that the character, who I'll just call the subject of the song, is treated in the second person. So the person who the song is being sung to is you. So you're on the phone with your girlfriend. She's upset. We can maybe guess that like the narrator is longing for this person just from this first line, but it's not explicit yet. And I actually really like how the longing that the narrator feels lies as suggestion until we get to the chorus, and it just kind of explodes out there.
Well, the title is also "You Belong With Me."
Well, yeah, you could figure it out from there, I suppose. But if you're just looking at the lyrics, I'm saying. And so the first stanza of the first verse ends with the line, "She doesn't get your humor like I do." So this is the first time that she uses "I" in the song. And so now we see that she's not just telling a story, but it's from her perspective, which again, I guess you could gather just from the title, "You Belong With Me," but it kind of makes it like a letter to the subject of the song. So at this point, we have the three characters of the song. We have the narrator, the I, we have the subject, the you, and then we have the third person, the girlfriend, who's typically the she. And the second stanza has something important to do. It sets up the contrast between the girlfriend and the narrator. They're like the two opposing forces, the she and the I. So Taylor Swift sings, "I'm in the room." She just says "the room." I guess it's her room. "I'm in the room. It's a typical Tuesday night." And one thing that she does a lot in her writing is she uses Tuesday or Wednesday as a stand-in for like a normal day. Just like that. That's how you know it's a normal, boring day. Is it Tuesday or Wednesday? If she mentions that. She does that in the song "Begin Again." She says, "On a Wednesday, it began again." Like it's just a boring, normal day.
Do you remember those pizza commercials where they personified the days, Dan?
No.
I thought those were brilliant, where like Friday and Saturday were the cool guys and Tuesday is a loser, but they're putting the pizza deal on a Tuesday because I guess people don't order nearly as much pizza on a Tuesday, and that makes suddenly everybody loves the Tuesday guy. You're never going to see Taylor Swift dating the Tuesday pizza commercial guy.
All right, so now we're at the first pre-chorus. And I think this might be my favorite set of lyrics in the whole song. So it goes, "But she wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts, she's cheer captain and I'm on the bleachers, dreaming about the day when you wake up and find that what you're looking for has been here the whole time." So there's a lot going on here that's great. The all-American images of the cheer captain and the bleachers. And it gradually builds to, you know, what we could guess from the start, from the title, what's inferred, but becomes more and more explicit as we go to the pre-chorus and then to the chorus itself, which is the longing that the narrator, the I, feels for the subject of the song, the you. Another thing that's kind of interesting here, one reason I wanted to look at the lyrics separate from the video itself, is that although the girlfriend is explicitly a female and she's a cheer captain, we actually don't get very much about the narrator. The only thing that we get is basically what her relationship is with the you, who we know to be a guy. And we assume that the narrator is a she because of Taylor singing and Taylor Swift is a young woman. And because the music video depicts this pretty much verbatim. So that's the image that we have. But one thing I've always liked about this song is you could actually read this as being from the perspective of like a male best friend who's in the closet. It's like a queer awakening almost. And honestly, if you follow the lyrics all the way through with that thought, that reading ends up holding up really well. I'm not going to dwell on that or like bring that up too much, but I actually think it's worth thinking about if you go listen to the song again. Like, what if this song was about a guy who's in love with his best friend, but he can't talk about it because he's growing up in, you know, rural America where you couldn't talk about those things. And on that note, I actually want to point listeners toward another one of Taylor Swift's masterpieces of a song, which is Betty, which was released on her terrific 2020 album, Folklore. And this kind of calls back to the same all-American teenager imagery and has the same sort of country-tinged production that she often had around the You Belong With Me era back in 2008. But it very aggressively leverages the ambiguity of the narrator. And it also kind of juxtaposes the whole scenario with some unexpected swearing, which kind of throws off the familiar texture even more. But that one, like, it's built entirely around having the audience not be clear exactly what the narrator, who the narrator is in relationship to Betty, the subject of the song. And I think it's really interesting.
Well, the music video for this song, You Belong With Me, gets interesting with the narrator also.
Oh, yeah. Yes. We'll get into that for sure. And one other song that's sort of a self-response by Taylor that is kind of in response to this sort of straightforward high school romance is a song called Miss Americana and the Heartbreak Prince, which is off the album Lover from 2019. And in that one, she kind of takes the high school romance imagery that she trafficked in a lot early in her career and like brings it out in a heightened satirical sort of way. I recommend that one as well. But anyways, back to You Belong With Me. A little more on the lyrics. So the chorus, the lyrics are, if you could see that I'm the one who understands you, been here all along, why can't you see you belong with me? And Brian, here's where I'll point out, and we can talk a little bit more about this, that this song and the music video is basically a retelling of the type of story that I've brought up a whole bunch of times in here. But from the girl's perspective instead of the guy's perspective, where there's a platonic girl best friend who's longing romantically for her bestie, but the bestie has his eyes on the popular bombshell. So we'll definitely opine on that a little bit more. I'm sure you noticed that as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I didn't pick up that that's what you were putting down earlier when you said it was the most Dancore, but now I see it.
So onto the second verse of the song here, which does two things. First, it efficiently describes the friendship between the narrator, the I, and the subject, the you, the boy. Walk in the streets with you in your worn out jeans. I can't help thinking this is how it ought to be. Laughing on a park bench, thinking to myself, hey, isn't this easy? And there's some great imagery in here too, which gets lifted directly for the video. You know that a song's imagery is good when you can basically just straight up adapt it in the video. The second verse also draws a bit about how the girlfriend is bringing down the bright smile of the song subject. So it's not just like longing because I want you, but because she's bad for you. She's making you worse. So then we get a pre-chorus and chorus again, but now we're at the song's bridge. And the song's bridge is interesting because it describes a really climactic confrontation that actually is not in the video, interestingly. And it's one of the only things that gets described in the song that's not in the video. So the bridge goes, I remember you driving to my house in the middle of the night. I'm the one who makes you laugh when you know you're about to cry. I know your favorite songs and you tell me about your dreams. Think I know where you belong. Think I know it's with me. So like we don't have a running to her crying in the middle of the night scene in the music video. I know I said before that the pre-chorus is my favorite set of lyrics, but this bridge actually might be my favorite set of lyrics in the song. Like, I think it actually touches on something really nice, which is that when you're a teenager and you're connecting with someone else, it's a combination of like surface level stuff. Like, knowing and respecting each other's taste in music. Like, for me, that was something I definitely did when I was trying to get closer to girls in high school. You know, something that I could talk about with them and show that I cared about her tastes. But it's also like something I did with my best friends. Like, it is a real way that I connected with people. Like, my best friend in high school is a guy named Tyler, and we introduced each other to a ton of different music, like stuff that I knew I gave to him, stuff that he knew he gave to me. But I also like that those lyrics talk about a deeper connection than that, where you tell me about your dreams, basically being as like a stand-in for like understanding each other's life ambitions and values. And to me, that resonates that like adolescence is all about discovering what these things are for yourself and sharing those with the people you love and your friends and the people you know. And I actually think it's even in the simple way that Taylor writes about it, it's kind of like a beautiful image of adolescent connection. That's like this combination of shallow and deep.
Two quick things about that. So the slideshow videos that you and Tyler used to edit for the marching band, like banquets, were definitely influential on my wanting to edit videos.
Oh, really?
Yes. Yes. I'm just now putting that together. It's just dawning on me now that you mentioned Tyler, because I definitely remember him too. He was a funny guy. This is a little off topic. Not quite, though. Broadly, I like Taylor Swift songs. The one I can't stand is Bad Blood. I just think that's such an obnoxious song.
I don't like that one either, to be honest. Yeah. She's not good at being mean, honestly. I never like it when she's mean. Maybe the one exception is Better Than Revenge, but even that one's a little silly. So then the way that the song ends, we get a couple repetitions of the chorus. We get some slight twists on the lyrics, but it's more of mostly the same. And the very final lyric is, "Have you ever thought just maybe you belong with me, you belong with me?" Definitely a song where you hear the title a lot in it. But it's sung well. It's got like the way there's a sense of longing in "You Belong With Me."
Yeah, I appreciate you dissecting the lyrics a little bit, because what I take away is na-na t-shirt, na-na short skirts, na-na-na-na-na-na-na bleachers. Yeah.
Yeah. There's another thing that I want to point out here, which is that Taylor Swift has always loved, but like especially early in her career, a very specific writing technique for the end of her songs, which is that, yeah, she repeats the chorus a couple times at the end of the song. That's something that pretty much all pop artists do. But one thing that Taylor Swift specifically does is the very last iteration of the chorus, she rewrites from a new perspective. She makes it a mirror image of what we've already heard. And she flips it in a way that kind of makes it like a twist, but like a happily ever after twist that resolves the song's conflict. So for example, in the song Love Story, "It's a Love Story, Baby, Just Say Yes," she spends the first few choruses describing how she wants her own love story with the object of her affection. And then in the final chorus, it's accompanied by just this apocalyptically great key change that just like shatters you when you hear it in a good way. She goes up a half step, I think it is. Maybe it's a whole step, but I think it's a half step. She sings the chorus again, but now she sings it from the guy's perspective. And now what he's doing is he's basically singing about a love story too, but here he's actually proposing marriage to her in the final chorus of Love Story.
Go put on a white dress, baby, just say yes. Although they keep calling each other Romeo and Juliet, who very distinctly did not have a happy ending.
That's a very good point. Scarlet Letter in there, too. It's like, have you read Scarlet Letter? I don't think you have. And honestly, even if you just take that at face value, like, she spends the whole song singing about how will he ever reciprocate my love? And then he just comes in, bam, with a marriage proposal. It's like, dude, I didn't even know you liked me. Now you're trying to marry me? Like, pump the brakes just a little, pal. But maybe imagined, maybe metaphorical, but I don't know. That's always made me laugh. So that's one example of her doing it. Another one is the song Speak Now, which is another one of my favorites by her. That's off of an album that's also called Speak Now. It's the title track. And in that one, she is imagining herself interrupting a wedding at the Speak Now or Forever Hold Your Peace moment of the ceremony. And it's got a really great progression throughout the story. She imagines herself doing it. And then in the second last chorus, she doesn't just imagine doing it. That's her actually interrupting a wedding. And it like takes out the background production. So it's got this dramatic impact to it. And then the very last time she sings the chorus, it's the groom singing it back to her. And she flees the altar with Taylor Swift, leaving behind his nasty bride and reciprocating his love for Taylor Swift. So that's something that she does a lot in her songs, is like take the last chorus and flip it back on itself. But she actually does not do this in You Belong With Me. And I actually think it's the right choice. I think this song works better that we don't get a happily ever after. It's just hanging, unrequited love. And I think that serves the song well. Now, in the music video, it is requited. We'll get to that. But I think that technique is more often than not kind of corny. And if I had to guess, the co-writer, Liz Rose, probably encouraged her not to do it this time around, because basically none of the Liz Rose co-writes use that same narrative structure where the last version of the chorus is like a mirror from a new perspective that gives a happily ever after. Just a couple other thoughts on the lyrics. So one is not the lyrics themselves, but like kind of the reputation of the lyrics. So there's this, it's mentioned a bunch of times on Wikipedia. There's this supposed controversy that this song is slut shaming towards the third character, the she.
Oh, just because they say short skirt?
Yeah, but like, that's one of the stupidest takes I've heard, because like, read the lyrics. Other than just saying short skirts, there's nothing in there that demeans the girlfriend character, except to basically say that she doesn't know the guy the way that I do. She's not right for that guy. That's not slut shaming. I think people are projecting too much onto the video from that.
Yeah.
Another take I've heard on You Belong With Me is that it's kind of pandering to like conservative values or like the wholesome classic image in a way that she would kind of come to regret. And I think this is kind of stupid too, because she came from the Nashville country music machine. That was the tradition she was writing in.
Yeah, she's got that red lip classic thing that you like.
Exactly. Like that's how the music industry she grew up in. Of course, some of the imagery she writes in is like traditional Heartland America stuff. And like, honestly, go watch any of teen soaps and dramas from the era. And like, that stuff is in there. It's not a uniquely Taylor Swift thing. So I think you can just ignore those aspects of the discourse around You Belong With Me. One more thing on the song itself before we get to the video. So there has been an ongoing legal dilemma in which Taylor Swift owns the rights to the compositions of the songs, but not the recordings of the songs for, I think it's her first five albums. And so she's been re-releasing them with new recordings that she owns and calling them Taylor's version. So you'll see Fearless, parentheses, Taylor's version. And she re-records all the songs, and then she includes some new tracks that she wrote from that era, basically, in the re-release. And I tend to think that most of the re-recordings are worse than the original. A couple of them have been better or have done something interesting. But like, for example, take You Belong With Me. She wrote it and sang it when she was like 18 and 19 and 20 years old, you know? And like, there's a certain authenticity in feeling that kind of teenage love when you're that old. And like, when you're in your mid-30s, you know, re-recording that, early to mid-30s, you're obviously going to be like putting on a little bit more of an affectation for that. Like, it's going to be a little bit more performative and less authentic. And I think that carries in her.
Still, though, I want her to be able to make her money.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't begrudge her that. But just, I mean, I think it's actually like, out of all of the things that she's done, the way that she's been able to make these re-releases of her old music into like actual monumental album releases that like top the charts when it's re-releasing songs we've all already heard 1,000 times is crazy impressive. That might be like the single savviest thing that she's done as a recording artist. So, and I'm good for her. Own your music, you know? Kind of sucks that she doesn't get to own the original recordings. I mean, the music industry is cruel to creators, particularly young ones trying to get their break. And it was 2022 when she did the You Belong With Me and Fearless Taylor's version. So I listened to that again as well. I definitely prefer the original still, but yeah.
On the subject of what's country and what's pop and where does the boundary lie, did you know that Lionel Richie did an album of all covers of his songs in country style where he collabed with country artists?
No, that's awesome, though. I would listen to that.
It's a great album. I was looking up Dancing on the Ceiling, and what came up was the version with a bunch of banjos. And... like, yeah, I think it's called Tuskegee is the name of the album, but it's pretty good.
That's cool. Well, keep Lionel Richie on the mind, Brian. We're going to hear his name tonight, or maybe not tonight. But we're going to hear his name at some point. But I am now ready, Brian. We've talked about the song. We've talked about the artist. Now let's talk about the video, which is, of course, the ostensible selection of today. So the music video was produced and directed by Roman White. So Roman White is this guy who's kind of a fixture of the Nashville country music scene. He's directed over 100 country and country pop music videos. I haven't seen him in the credits do one since 2020, so he might be not doing music videos anymore. But he did like almost all of Carrie Underwood's singles, for example, and he did a bunch of Taylor Swift's too. He also has directed 2 feature films. There was a sentimental teen comedy from 2015 called Summer Forever, and then a Christian romance musical called A Week Away that came out in 2021. So I haven't seen either of those, and they both have mediocre reviews, but honestly, both sound like easy watching to me. So maybe I will watch them someday. Now, of course, the video stars Taylor Swift, and it also stars as the subject, the you, a guy named Lucas Till. So he is a Disney actor from that era.
Yeah, apparently he played Hannah Montana's love interest.
Yeah, in the Hannah Montana movie. And actually, Taylor Swift was somehow involved in that movie. I don't know if she made a cameo or did a song for it, but she met him during the making of that and then met him again at the premiere when they were just getting ready to cast the co-lead in this music video. Cause I think that came out in 2009, like right around when they were about to make this music video, that being the Hannah Montana movie. And she recruited him to be the co-lead. And apparently they actually like dated for a few weeks right around the time of the filming of this music video. So you could almost call it a showmance, maybe. It was never a serious relationship, but apparently they went on a few dates. And I would describe Lucas Till as like a stereotypically handsome 2000s blonde boy, but really not too tall. It's like he's got kind of dirty blonde hair, a little bit of a cleft chin. Any Lucas Till thoughts?
Well, yes, sort of. What it makes me think of is that music video that Michael Bublé did where he's in the grocery store. Just Haven't Met You Yet, where he actually did like marry the actress in that music video. And I mean, I guess I can see the temptation if like the studio brings you the most beautiful person on earth. It's like, well, there, all the work is done. It's like, yeah, just make a good impression and you're set.
That's funny. So Lucas Till has actually had a pretty solid acting career. Brian, you and I probably know him best because he was Havoc in the X-Men series that kicked off with X-Men First Class. So he's the guy who shoots energy out of his chest.
Okay. I do. I guess I remember that. Yeah. I really like First Class. I like X-Men First Class. It was on my top 100 list back in 2013. I mean, it is a well-done movie. It's an enjoyable watch. But primarily because when I went to see it at the movie tavern, they brought me a plate of free barbecue. I guess somebody ordered it, and then they're just like, it wasn't you? Well, do you want it anyway? I was like, okay. And thus, it was one of my best movie-going experiences. Just like, here's a plate of free barbecue.
That's awesome. That'll definitely boost any movie. Have this free food. Especially when you're a college kid.
You know? Yeah. And it was a pretty good movie, too, so...
Yeah, I wrote a review of it pretty recently on thegoodsreviews.com, and I liked it. I think I gave it a very good. So, Till is actually still acting to this day. He's had a pretty long career now. It seems that he gets put in these movies that have like quiet theatrical releases and then run on cable forever. So he was in this action movie called The Collective and this racial drama called Son of the South, where he played a good guy, white guy in it, apparently.
Yeah, the good guy, white guy. That's the role that you want. Like Brad Pitt when he produced 12 Years a Slave.
So that's Lucas Till. Now, Swift, Taylor Swift, this was her 15th music video. She's kind of interesting because traditionally, if you were one of the biggest pop stars, you also needed to cross that over into being a movie star too, and vice versa. But she hasn't really gone too hard on the trying to be a movie star thing. She's just done her music videos, and she's had a couple of smaller appearances in movies. But here's a fun fact. I mentioned that there would be a Seinfeld connection here. So one of the videos that she was in, it actually wasn't for her song. It was for a Brad Paisley song, but she appeared in it, was directed by Jason Alexander, George Costanza himself.
Wow.
Which is kind of random.
I'm almost surprised she didn't show up in like the last episode of Seinfeld. So many people are in Seinfeld just randomly. Like Bob Odenkirk and Sarah Silverman and like people who wouldn't really be anybody for like 10 years.
Yeah, Friends has a lot of those too. Like actors who would later be co-stars or stars of sitcoms like in the Parks and Rec days or The Office or whatever. But I really wish that You Belong With Me had been directed by George Costanza. That would have been like a whole nother level of me appreciating it. That's okay. It can be this other guy. And this was actually shot in Tennessee around Nashville. So you can find like which school it was shot at for the school dance and the school football scenes. And I imagine someone has probably like figured out the address where the houses were shot because it's shot at a real neighborhood and somewhere in Tennessee, not too far from Nashville. In just a couple of years, she would move away from Nashville to New York, which she would chronicle in her song Welcome to New York, which was the opener for her album 1989.
So I'm glad that you mentioned the houses, because what blew my mind when I started this music video, and I think I had seen it before, but watching it right after Tokimeki Memorial, it's the same setting. So you're in a bedroom looking out the window at the boy next door, in this case, who has a parallel bedroom in the adjacent house and can look the other way through the window. And this setup, looking out a window to the house next door and seeing like the silhouette of the crush over there, is where you spend all your time on the Tokimeki Memorial menu screen, where you're making all your choices. So it's like we're in this music video.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So just to set the scene, so I watched this music video maybe a dozen times in prep for this. One of the watch throughs, I counted every shot and I got to 120. I think that's the right number. I could be off by one or two because some of them are really quick. But you're right. So it's two houses, and they're definitely upper middle class houses. They're like close to each other. I think this is kind of a common thing when you have big houses, is you like expand the house, but you don't really expand the yard. So like the houses end up kind of close to each other.
It'd be hard to expand the yard. But yeah, it's like the McMansion phenomenon, that back in the day, big houses were built on big estates like Lord Fitzpatrick and Darby O'Gill. But nowadays, people want to have a lot of house, and they're on these pre-existing smaller plots.
And I don't know for sure, but I would guess, this is just a guess, that so the two houses, the left one is beige, the right one is kind of brick red. The left one is the boys, the right one is Taylor Swift's. I would guess that in that establishing shot, which is the first shot of the video, that the window for Taylor Swift's is digitally added. Because I just can't imagine having two windows that so directly face each other. They're like 15 feet apart, and they're both bedrooms. Like, that just doesn't make sense to
me. And yet that's exactly how it is in Tokimeki Memorial, and I have never been in a house like this. In my house, the windows are facing the house across the street, which is much further away.
Right. Yeah.
They don't look out the side of the house into the house next door.
I mean, but it works for the image of the Tokimeki Memorial and for this music video. So we see Lucas Till in one window, and in this opening scene, he's on the phone apparently arguing with a green t-shirt and PJ pants. And then in the other house is Taylor Swift. She's not wearing too much makeup, and she's wearing a t-shirt that has apparently been decorated by Sharpies to say Junior Jewels on it. And there's a bunch of names that signed it.
So what does that mean? What are the Junior Jewels?
That's a very good question. I want to say that I've always wanted to dress as Taylor Swift in this scene for Halloween, and me talking about this might be the push for me to do it this year, because you can actually buy a knockoff of this shirt on Etsy.
So wait a minute, that would, if you did that, you would have been at least two featured characters from our April Fool's episodes for Halloween, because you've been Zebra Man before. So now you just gotta be you could be Hardened Miner one year. Mr. Penders.
Yeah, or something. Who else could I be? Could I be the guy in the Garfield video?
That would be good. You could steal his look. He's basically got the Carl Sagan of a blazer over a turtleneck. Pretty simple.
Yeah. So I will add that I found a 16-minute making-of featurette for this video that I had never seen before and is pretty cool. And one thing they talk about is, according to this featurette, if we were to trust it, Taylor Swift actually saw one of the people in her touring band wearing it just like either on the bus or hanging out one day and thought it was like the ultimate image of like high school friendliness. It was an actual band camp shirt from when that person in the band, in her touring band, was like in a marching band in high school. And she asked her if she could wear it for the first scene of this video. And so I think it's the fiddle player. It was a quote unquote real band camp shirt that Taylor Swift was wearing. And I think Junior Jewels were to take that it's like a club and probably the marching band, but it's like all the juniors who are friends probably like made one together or something like that. We don't get an explanation. That's just my guess. Now, it's not a movie, it's a music video, so we don't get dialogue, so we don't get names for the characters, so we can just call them by their actor names. But we gather that Taylor Swift and Lucas Till are kind of longtime pals, and we see that they have this sort of habit, this sort of tradition or ritual, which is where they write messages to each other on sketch pads, and they hold up the messages, just like simple little messages. So in this first one, we see, as he's arguing with his girlfriend, she writes, "You okay?" question mark, and holds it up. And he like smiles and rolls his eyes and writes a reply that says, "Tired of drama." So I guess that's the arguing on the phone. And she writes, "Sorry," with a frowny face and holds it up. And then something strange happens. So she starts writing a note that says, "I love you." Like, she's going to confess her feelings. This is how we know that she has feelings for him. But like, as she's writing it, he closes the curtains before she can hold it up. There's a lot to unpack right here, Brian. Things I want to talk about. So we already talked about the windows in the opposing bedrooms. Why would he suddenly close the curtains when she's writing a note? Doesn't make sense. But he had left it open while he was arguing on the phone. I don't know why he abruptly closed it. That's fine. Whatever. Maybe he had to go get dinner or something. Whatever.
Maybe he suddenly had to take his clothes off.
Well, more thoughts on that in a second. I also think it's funny that her response to him saying that he's tired of drama with his girlfriend is that she's going to write, "I love you," like an unprompted confession of love from your friend would decrease the amount of drama in his love life. Maybe not read the moment there, Taylor Swift.
Got to take any opening that appears.
Also worth pointing out that geeky junior Jules Taylor Swift, quite possibly the least convincing, like dressed down, glasses wearing, just needs a makeover teen girl of all time. Either her or Jennifer Love Hewitt in Trojan War, which we talked about one time. Definitely not convinced that she's this frumpy, unpopular girl.
Yeah, well, then we see who her competition is.
Yeah. Okay, so he's gone away. So now she's singing to herself in the mirror. And there's an important bit here where she, in rapid succession, rotates through a bunch of different outfits. And these outfits all kind of match vaguely stereotypical social outcast types. Like there's one that's a goth girl and one that's a hippie, and one that's a super dweeb with pigtails, and one who's an arty type with like an off-center ponytail. And then she's back in the Junior Jules shirt, still dancing around singing to her hairbrush, and Lucas Till opens the curtain again. And he looks into Taylor Swift's window, and she's dancing around singing, and he laughs. She's dancing as if no one is watching, that's adorable, etc. So, at the risk of overthinking this a little bit, I'm wondering a few things. So first, did she change in and out of these outfits? Like, did she actually do that? And if so, did she open and close her curtains every time? Or does she, like, just change clothes with the window open where he can peep on her changing her clothes whenever she does? And how often has he tried to do that? And given that he's a teenage boy, the answer is probably constantly he's tried to do that. That would be, like, a risk of having rooms that are bedrooms directly opposite each other.
Yeah, probably why it doesn't happen a lot. Maybe ever. I like your theory that they're digital windows, in which case, like, what are they even looking at? But, I guess it's a set, but...
Yeah, like, only the one shot is where I think it's digital. Like, I think everything else after that is a set to make you think where the things are.
Okay. I also like the idea of them, like, doing green screen acting and not seeing each other. Holding up, like, a green-painted kickball saying, "This is Taylor Swift."
But back to the outfits for a second. I think this is kind of important to part of what makes the song work is that it's written so universally that it's like almost impossible not to see some of your own feelings in this song. Like you're going to recognize the feeling of unrequited attraction towards someone who you've considered a friend or like an acquaintance, you know, like that is not specifically a frumpy girl thing. It's like a literally anyone in all of modern history scenario, you know, that's something that just happens. And yeah,
and the idea of trying on a bunch of different identities is very much like Tokimeki Memorial,
right? And I would say adolescence in general. Yeah,
right. But like, which stat are you maxing? Which club are you joining?
Are you the arty one or the geeky one? Right. All right, so now we're the next day. It's a bench in front of their houses. Taylor is sitting there. She's dressed like an elementary school librarian. She's got this like cardigan and she's cradling this book that she's reading. Lucas Till comes out. He's just wearing a t-shirt and jeans. He sits right next to her and like starts talking to her and like reaches up and pushes her bangs behind her ears. And like for a moment we get a shot that, oh yeah, Taylor Swift, she's a ridiculously pretty person, even behind those glasses. And also just like a weird thing to do to your friend if you're a platonic friend. And he like basically starts talking to her. Maybe he's talking about, I don't know, who knows what they're even talking about. Actually, the featurette describes what Taylor Swift imagines they're thinking about. I'll talk about that when I talk about the featurette here in a minute. But I love this shot because, you know, we can only hear the song. We can't hear what he's saying. But then she just starts singing along. Like in the same shot, she's singing the lyrics while he's talking to her, and it's just kind of jarring because like we're trying to imagine them sitting there talking together, but like she's looking off in the distance singing the lyrics while he's talking to her. I guess it's like, I don't know what the diegesis is here is what I'm saying. I guess it's like this is what's happening in her head as he's talking to her. But I always find that moment kind of striking, kind of odd. And then we get to the best part of the video. Just one of the great twists of the 21st century in music video or in any film. By my count, the 44th out of 120 shots, we see the girlfriend pull up. So she's driving a cherry red convertible. She's got long brown hair. She's staring at Lucas Till. He walks over. She like takes off her sunglasses, pulls him in, gives him a kiss. And then bam, we see the girlfriend's face. Boy, that face sure looks familiar. That's right. The girlfriend is played by evil Taylor Swift. She's both the narrator, the good girl, the nice one, the one who needs to win the attraction of the boy, and she's the evil girlfriend too. It's double casting, Brian. It's so good. What do you think of this?
It's really good. It's a good idea. And it's the best time it's been done since in Pokemon, the American dub at least. It's the same voice actors for Brock and Misty as for Jesse and James of Team Rocket.
Whoa.
So it's like your friends and your enemies that are always around you. Same people, Dan.
That's crazy. One thing I'll say is, in the spirit of this being a very Dancore music video, like one of the ideas that I have for if I were given the full budget to produce a feature-length film is a adaptation of this music video to feature length, but I absolutely need the protagonist and the antagonist to be the same actress. So that would be one of the things I would do if I had an unlimited budget to make whatever movie I wanted. I actually think that this is more than just kind of funny, though. It's like, it's kind of insightful. It's like, yeah, we get to see Taylor Swift camping it up as a villain mean girl, but also, there's like a fine line between the hero and the villain. It's kind of like in The Office, you're rooting for Jim and Pam to get together. But you only have to tweak that perspective a little bit, and you can make Jim the villain and Roy the hero, or something like that. Like, I don't know. I just think there's something insightful about having the same actor playing both the hero and the villain. It almost makes me want to record a podcast where, like, I'm arguing with myself or something like that.
What does Belloc say in Raiders of the Lost Ark? It would take just a shove to make you like me, to push you out of the light.
That's a good one. I didn't know we'd be bringing Belloc into this, but I think it fits. I also think it's pretty cool how like it doesn't get flaunted too hard. Like, I am honestly not even sure that I knew it was evil Taylor Swift the first time I watched the music video. I'm not sure I processed that it was the same person.
The wig she has on definitely changes the look.
Yeah. She makes a very convincing mean girl, which actually brings me to another point, which is that I think in real life, Taylor Swift, even before fame, is way more likely to be the high drama, popular girlfriend, cheer captain than the mousy girl next door, you know?
Yeah, it's like Vanessa Hudgens being in the Mathlete in High School Musical.
Yeah, even more than that, but the same idea for sure. So we then have evil Taylor Swift glare at good Taylor Swift, and now we transition to the next scene, which is a high school football game. So one reason I love this video is that two of my favorite totems from high school are high school football games and high school dances, and we get both of them in this. So, like, high school football games are to me, in some ways, like the essence of teenage life in some ways, because you get kids of all different types united together, sharing a space, kind of like rooting for the same thing in their own ways. And football games have an inherent drama. There's a winner and a loser, and like how people feel about that is kind of interesting. And it's where you get to be like more or less unsupervised around kids your age, just hanging out, you know, like even in school, you're there for school, but like at a football game, it's there just to be social, just to bond with other people. And yeah, I liked marching band and just the cool air and the snacks and all that. To me, it was an important thing.
Yeah. I was going to say, I like the weather. It's cool. and I would go to the concession stand and buy Nerds ropes. That's what I would get, where it's like a bunch of the hard candy but stuck on a Twizzler.
To me, the it's the salt pretzels, the jumbo pretzels that are iconic. But just as the lyrics dictate, evil Taylor Swift is indeed the cheer captain, and good Taylor Swift is, as again in the song, on the bleachers. Here she's playing clarinet in the marching band, which is where I will point out that I have some bias here, because I met my now wife when we were both in high school, when I was in the marching band and she was in the marching band, and she played clarinet just like Taylor Swift does here. So this is tickling my nostalgia receptors here. We see that Lucas Till is apparently a wide receiver on the football team. And when we see the cheerleader outfits, the team is called the Knights. Evil Taylor Swift is kind of preoccupied doing her cheer routines, and good Taylor Swift is cheering enthusiastically in the stands. But Lucas Till ends up catching the game-winning touchdown, and he gets lifted on his shoulders. And something else I'll point out here, Brian, the Knights, they have the Notre Dame colors, the gold helmets, the navy jerseys. So basically what we're seeing right here, Notre Dame jerseys lifted up on the shoulders. This is the end of Rudy here, too. We get one shot of the end of Rudy in this You Belong With Me as well. Which, again, just piling on how much this is Dan Corr epitomized. And so he runs over to go celebrate with his girlfriend, Evil Taylor Swift. But at that exact moment, she's flirting with another football player. Like, how he even got there and started flirting with her as they're celebrating this touchdown, I'm not sure. But we get a shot of good Taylor Swift shaking her head in astonishment. End the football game scene. So now we're cutting to the next night, and it's a school dance. I think what we could probably take away from this is that it's homecoming. In the making of featurette, they call it prom. But like, homecoming was when you had a big football game, and then the next night you had the dance. So that's how I'm reading this, is this is homecoming. And we're back in the bedrooms at nighttime again. And good Taylor Swift is working on homework. She's wearing a periodic table t-shirt, which I would definitely wear if I got my own version of it. It's like this black t-shirt that has the periodic table on it. Prime, like, I'm pretending to be a geek costume. And Lucas Till, he's wearing a tux. He's about to go to the dance, and he holds up a sign in their little, like, writing something on a sketch pad. He says, "You going tonight?" And she holds up a reply that says, "No, studying." And then he holds up a reply that says, "Wish you were, wink," and then walks away. And Taylor smirks, and then she happens to see her "I love you" sign from earlier. And this is, I guess, a moment where she gets a flash of inspiration. She can go to the dance. She will go to the dance. But I love this, Brian. What she does first, she literally does the Clark Kent maneuver. She slides the glasses right off her face like she's transforming into Superman. And it's timed just right, because this is when the song gets kind of quiet. And so it's got like this sort of gasp of like a held breath almost of the drama that's about to happen. So I think this is a funny moment. I love that she just pulls off her glasses. Don't need this anymore. Oh, it turns out I'm pretty underneath these. Now we cut to the dance itself. So at the dance, good Taylor Swift has arrived. And hold on. Taylor Swift is beautiful. Whoever would have guessed this? Hold the fort on this one. And she's dressed in all white, virginal, bridal, angelic white, I would say. Her hair is lovingly curled, and she's now has makeup applied. She's had her makeover. At what time she had her makeover, I'm not sure. I guess she did her hair herself, because it's the same night when he was already headed to the dance. But like, when she arrives, the crowds part like it's the Red Sea, and all the other high school dancers are gasping at her, unable to believe that Taylor Swift could be this beautiful. And honestly, like, I desperately wish, if you want to talk about like going back in time and changing something, I desperately wish I could have been an extra in this dance crowd. That would have been like one of the crowning achievements of my life. Like, that's, I wish I could have been at that scene, pointing myself every time I play the video.
I'm wondering what evil Taylor Swift's name would be. Would it be Taylor Lethargic? Taylor Slow?
Oh, interesting.
Who is the goofest to Taylor Swift's gallant?
I like that. So I think what I might do if I were writing this is name her Allison, which is Taylor Swift's middle name, in my imaginary screenplay where I'm adapting this. Taylor is the good one and Allison is the evil one.
Roll yet. Taylor backwards.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of which, I'm reading Holes to my daughters right now. Stanley Yelnats.
That's a good book.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I'm pretty close to Taylor Swift's age. I would have been 21 when this was filmed. So like I could have passed as a high school student. I could have been an extra there, Brian. But Lucas Till, he spots good Taylor Swift and he gasps in the realization that she is indeed beautiful. And he starts walking towards her, almost literally licking his chops, getting ready to kiss her. But of course, we need the one last intervention of evil Taylor Swift. And I love that she's wearing devil's red, like the same color as the convertible, and tries to like flirt with him again. But he's wiser now, Brian. He has seen that good Taylor Swift can take off her glasses and he has no need for evil Taylor Swift now. So he pushes her aside. And I like that we get a moment of seeing evil Taylor Swift mouth the word, "What?" Like in disbelief that he would do this. And this is a cute little finale here. Good Taylor Swift pulls out the I love you sign, the one that she wrote at the beginning of the video, and shows it to Lucas Till. Lo and behold, he pulls out of his pocket an I love you sign as well. I suppose he has been trying to find a way to articulate his feelings just as she has. And they did it in the same way without realizing it, which is totally adorable. But honestly, I've been thinking about this. Like, it really doesn't stand up to much scrutiny. Why would he bring that with him? Basically, he would need to know, A, that she felt the same way, or at least that he would be comfortable doing it, whether or not she brought his.
Well, maybe he's got all kinds of cards in his pockets, Dan. He could be ready for every scenario.
At all times. He would also need to know that she would go to the dance, even though she explicitly told him she wasn't going. And, oh, great coincidence, she brought the sign herself. Like, if all of those things hadn't lined up, him having the sign just wouldn't make sense. But I like this headcanon that he's got all sorts of signs that he can just whip out. Like, just friends, haha, is another one he can pull out. But they both smile, they embrace. And I like that, like, right at the moment before they're about to kiss, she looks at him and she mouths, "You belong with me," matching the last time it says it in the lyrics, like almost when she would say it in the movie script, if it were a movie script, you know? And I think that's just a nice moment of direction and synergy there. And then they kiss and we get one last shot of evil Taylor Swift. And then we fade to black. We hear the last power chord strum linger for just a second. And that's the end of the You Belong With Me music video. There we go. So I'm not done yet, Brian. A few more important bits of info.
Right. You need to give the bottom line.
Yes. First, some ephemera. So like I mentioned, there's the making of featurette. And it's funny how it's four times long as long as the actual video. Like just how his video about Tokimeki Memorial would certainly be several times longer than an actual playthrough of it, you know. And in it, we get a lot of shots that weren't included. And so it's kind of cool if you've seen that video 1,000 times like I have to go watch it and see like, oh, they have this other shot of it here. Oh, and one thing you might have been wondering is, well, there's a couple of shots where you see both Taylor Swift's. How did they do that? Well, it turns out they had a double. They had a stand-in who looked a lot like her, who actually played both good Taylor Swift when Taylor Swift was playing evil Taylor Swift and evil Taylor Swift when Taylor Swift was playing good Taylor Swift. So both of them actually kind of swap. She's like the yang to Taylor Swift's yin in those shots.
Yeah. They couldn't pull off the feeders trick where they just actually had a twin in reserve.
No, I guess not. Yeah. One thing that was funny is I mentioned, okay, the shot where they're sitting on the bench together. What Taylor Swift says in the recording that like what the thing they would be talking about is like, you know, political debates and my model of George Washington. And I'm like, what is she talking about? That political debates wouldn't be casual talk on a bench before a day of school. And what does it mean she has a model of George Washington? Is that a thing that people can get?
Maybe that's her concept of politics. Any president, if you're talking about them, that's politics.
I guess. It just raises more questions than it answers for me. Like, what is the political ideology that's going down?
She's actually a Federalist, Dan.
Whig Party.
She wishes that we had seen a President Hamilton after Adams.
We also get some shots in this making of featurette of the director, Roman White, who actually kind of gave me the willies. He's got like an over-friendly, cool grown-up vibe. Like, I watched the first episode of that Dark Truth about Nick TV, and it was a little bit of like how Dan Schneider was in that. Not quite as bad, but like just a little bit of the same vibes. He's also kind of like a big overweight guy who's real friendly with the teens, you know. But I'm sure he's nice because everybody there says that he's the nicest guy. And that's also where we learn about the origin of the Junior Jules shirt. And there's this one extended bit that goes on for like more than a minute where Taylor Swift talks about how Lucas Till likes video games, and so does the director. But, you know, she can talk about anything except video games. She just has no interest in it. And then she does like this elaborate rant where she pretends to be interested in video games and like makes up what it sounds like to her. Like, oh, and then they go to Battlestar Galactica, and it's super duper cringe. I don't know why they included it, but it did make me laugh. And it definitely played up the concept that, like, in real life, Taylor Swift would be the evil version, not the good version.
So, you know, if you're doing a playthrough where you're going after Taylor Swift, don't talk about video games. That's the wrong dialogue option to choose.
There you go, yeah. Also, a bunch of footage of her dancing and badly playing the clarinet. And they kind of focused on, like, more than I would have expected them to, the lead up to the filming of the kiss and how awkward Lucas Till is about having to film a kiss with Taylor Swift. And it has an added charge because we know that they either were dating or were about to start dating at that time. And then they both talk about it being really awkward afterwards and how like the extras were like, oh, they're kissing, and making it more awkward in the background. Two more factoids from the making of. One is that the marching band is actually all members of her touring band that we see, which is kind of a cool. You included your touring band in the video. I think that's neat. And then during the football shoots, Lucas Till was having a really hard time catching the ball. He kept dropping the football. They had to do it like 15 times before he was able to catch it, which is kind of funny that he's playing the athlete and can't even catch the ball. It's like in Get Your Head in the Game from High School Musical, how they're supposed to be basketball athletes, but they don't really seem like basketball athletes.
I'm imagining a version of this music video that's more channeling The Room, because we've got tuxedos, we've got football tossing.
Maybe that was like a deep cut by Roman White or whatever his name is. Like, he was trying to bring in some Room imagery in there. But it's a cute little featurette. I'm glad I watched it. So we're almost done, Brian. I said a piece we needed to talk about was the fallout of this music video. And I know we've been going on a while. Thank you for letting me do my long form YouTube video spiel here. The elephant in the room. The reason that You Belong With Me is a key piece of maybe the most important cultural moment in American culture, at least, of the past two decades. And that is September 13th, 2009. The 2009 MTV Video Music Awards. So one thing to say is the Video Music Awards, the VMAs, they're kind of bullshit. They're like the third most important music awards. And at this point, you're like deep in the bowels of just one person in the industry giving a pat on the back to another person in the industry. Like, it's basically just a means to talk more about musicians and see some live performances.
Right. It's just an ad for what you're putting out.
Right. But I will say the 2009 one was actually kind of a significant one because it was the first VMA after Michael Jackson died, and he obviously made some of the most important music videos of all time. And this was also like a sort of glory age for music videos, and a lot of them were getting honored at this. And then the big thing happened, the thing that we still haven't stopped talking about. So the award Best Female Video, both You Belong With Me was nominated, both You Belong With Me and the song Single Ladies by Beyonce were nominated. You Belong With Me was selected as the winner. And as Taylor Swift was getting the award, Kanye West storms on stage, takes the mic as she was giving her thank yous, her acceptance. And he says, "Yo, Taylor, I'm really happy for you. I'm gonna let you finish. But Beyonce had one of the best videos of all time. One of the best videos of all time." And then he gave the mic back, got booed off stage, kicked out of the VMA.
And the president called him a jackass.
Yes. Taylor stuttered through the rest of her acceptance there. The weirdest thing is, and I don't know how many people actually remember this, is Single Ladies ended up winning the Video of the Year Grand Prize. It didn't win Best Female Video, but it did win the Video of the Year Grand Prize, which begs the question, I guess, of like, how could it be the best video of the year, but not the best female video of the year?
And what does it even mean to be a female video?
I think that means by a female artist, but that's a good point, too. And when she won it, Beyonce invited Taylor on stage to finish her speech. Because, of course, Taylor had been flustered to finish it when Kanye interrupted her. And by the way, I kind of agree with Kanye that Beyonce's Single Ladies is kind of more of like capital A art in terms of like challenging how we think about music and images and stuff and like doing really interesting things. I mean, I personally like get more of a kick out of You Belong With Me, but like if you're talking about what actually used the medium in compelling ways, yeah, Single Ladies is one of the most important of the past 30 years. But I think this evening just reshaped modern pop music. I really do believe this. So for one, it really jump-started Taylor's career and her image, like made her into the sympathetic figure, which she has perfectly harnessed. And like she really used that to kind of bring her to the next level. It even actually helped Kanye. He kind of turned into this villain slash anti-hero for a few years where he like had to purge his demons and he made some of his most creative music. And like, honestly, modern pop and hip hop and R&B is still ripping off some of his innovations from that phase that came after the VMAs, like the My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy and Yeezus and 808s and Heartbreak was right before that. And this evening was also kind of like the birth of poptimism, not the official birth, but it kind of traces back to that. And poptimism is this kind of way you discuss music and music criticism, where it really emphasizes like positivity and viewing pop as like a refraction of progressive social consciousness. And I think there are some pros and cons to this way of like really celebrating pop music, as opposed to like the kind of classic idiom of criticism is like rock singer-songwriter forward, like Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Beatles focused, as opposed to like bringing and making it more female and more pop focused and more diverse. And really, Taylor Swift and Beyonce have kind of been the vanguards of this. And Kanye West has for years was like the perfect antagonist of this. He brought out this kind of hedonistic, misogynistic man that was like this frightening id as kind of the contrast. And I think this really has changed the way that music is talked about by people, like online and journalism, social media, even the way that artists kind of present themselves is kind of in this poptimism lens. And honestly, things got even darker from there because Kanye West took his villain role and like had a bipolar episode that he still hasn't really escaped. And he like embraced essentially Nazism and anti-Semitism. And it kind of kicked off when Trump was elected and he adopted that, but he like went way further right with it even more so. And he divorced Kim Kardashian and honestly has never and will never shake the stink that that had on his career, which is unfortunate because I think between him, Beyonce, and Taylor, in the immediate aftermath, Kanye's artistic peaks were the most interesting and the highest. But really a totally fascinating and seminal moment in modern cultural history, particularly music. All right, so now we're at, what did you call it? What's the last segment, Brian?
He had the bottom line.
Yeah.
He also had the itch the freak scratched, which I never fully understood, but is a good title.
Yeah, maybe the VMAs is the itch the freak scratch, and now we're on the bottom line. So the last thing I want to circle back to is this the most Dancore piece of filmed entertainment ever created? Here are the reasons it might be. I'm not saying it is, but the reasons it might be. So first of all, it's got that story structure. It's about a boy with a girl best friend. He needs to realize he has feelings for the girl. We've talked a lot about that in the pod's history. I don't need to relitigate it too much here, but it's something that I have felt personally brings out very meaningful themes that I connect to very well. And I even have written my own draft of a novel that basically has this story structure. And like I said, I would watch it as a feature length movie if they made this 3-minute music video into a 90-minute movie. It's also built around a great pop song, and like music being a central piece of a movie is something that's very important to me. It has some of my favorite totems from teen stories. It's got a football game and a high school dance, and it's got kind of campy, exaggerated mean girls, and it kind of fills the role of like the D-bag boyfriend, who's one of my favorite archetypes. I also mentioned it literally reenacts the climax of Rudy, which is like one of the ultimate Dan movies. And then just the fact that it's kind of saturated in the late aughts aesthetic that was the style when I was in high school and early college. It hits my nostalgia real hard. And the last thing is, it's got a lot of connections to my own romance in high school. So I haven't really talked much about it. I'm not going to right now, but someday I will. But like the concept of written messages being an aspect of how two people kind of fall in love with each other really was a part of how my now wife and I fell in love when we were seniors, when I was a senior in high school, and then the time after that. And I'll probably tell that story and what I mean by that, because it kind of actually is a story at some point, not right now, but at some point. But I don't know, Brian, what do you think of my theory that this is number one Dancore piece of filmed entertainment? I'm not sold on it, but what do you think?
I see it now. It's definitely like orange juice concentrate. Like, distill it down into a little tiny can. I don't know that you could get much purer than this. It doesn't take place in one night. It's close. I mean, there's definitely a pivotal night, but I think it's a longer time span, so.
Oh, yeah. It's like a weekend, yeah.
It's close, though. It's close.
Right. And by the way, September 13th, 2009 is when the VMAs were, so I said there would be a September 13th connection with Tokimeki Memorial.
Yeah. Although you could be right that it's the 15th, but if it is the exact same date, we got to go to the tape, because that would be insane. That would be like the singularity right there. The interconnectedness of the universe.
Yeah, I mean, I think just a lot of the concepts in You Belong With Me echo the way that Action Button Tim Rogers talked about Tokimeki Memorial, and like just how he thought about romance as a teen, and how he kind of went through this story that the Tokimeki Memorial High School. He talked about going back to high school again and again and again, which is kind of how I feel when I watch this movie. So I felt some, I agree that it ended up being quite a synergistic viewing experience, even though one was 6 hours and one was 3 minutes and 51 seconds.
It's the whole spectrum, orders of magnitude, but I'm glad that you assigned something short. I think it wouldn't work if we both assigned something that was 6 hours long.
Maybe next time I'll do the long thing and you'll do the short thing. I don't know. Or we can go back to both of us doing short things.
Maybe we need that breather. I think the record for most Briancore entries, Gravity Falls, and that's probably never going to be topped. But I'm glad that we could take this trip that we do every year on April 1st, where we are no longer bound. We are unfettered by the feature film form.
So now we'll do our signature section, where we each give the not quite a movie a rating on our 8-point goodness scale, ranging from very not good, which is a 1 out of 8, to our masterpiece rating, toward a good, which is an 8 out of 8. Brian, this time you get to go first. Is You Belong With Me good?
Okay. So, I don't want to be a downer. I do like it. I think it's a very effective music video. I'm going to give it a high 5. I like the song because it's very catchy. And you're right. It's like a 1-to-1 translation almost. I do love the twist where we get Taylor Swift in the dual roles. She is the yin and the yang. She's both sides of the mirror. So maybe that should give it a 6 for me. I'm like right on the cusp. But I think highest 5 for me.
Obviously, I'm giving this one a tour de good. It's a key Dan text. It's like on the short list of key Dan texts, the song and the music video. And is it actually that good? I don't know, but I do actually love it that much. So I have to give it the highest rating. It's a little campy, a little silly, but it just makes me ridiculously happy. And like I said, if you're like to talk about like what my ultimate guilty pleasure is, what's the most Dancore thing? There it is, right there. You Belong With Me in the music video. Go watch that. You understand how my brain works a little bit better than you did before. So there you go. Tour de good from Dan on You Belong With Me. And there we have it, Brian. I guess we are on to our next episode. And I believe I'm choosing. Is that right?
That sounds right. Yes, we've... With this episode, which has taken a while, we had some technical difficulties, but I'm sure it'll end up with one of our longer run times. We've crossed over midnight. It is now no longer April Fool's Day, Dan. We have to resume verisimilitude. The world is real again. Our actions have consequences.
The world is real, Brian, and we are the world, indeed. That's right. I'm going to do another music video. I'm not actually going to do just the music video, though. I'm going to do the documentary that just came out on Netflix called The Greatest Night in Pop, which is a documentary about the filming of the We Are the World music video. And that's where Lionel Richie comes into play, because he is a key figure.
We can talk supergroups. Yeah. We can sing Sending Our Love Down the Well from The Simpsons.
Yeah, there's some great anecdotes in this. I just want to relive some of the anecdotes. So, alrighty. Well, like you said, Brian, this one's run long. So thank you for indulging me. And good night.
Good night, Dan.
See you all later.
Happy April 1st, all y'all out there listening. Join us again.